trying to think how many years later they got a full-time rabbi. In fact, for a while before they had a place of worship, a temple, which was built in 1914, before that, they used to hold their services at Baptist Church, and various churches were nice enough to give them places.
And those Jews wanted a synagogue, first a burial ground. Usually a burial ground comes first, and then comes the synagogue. And so they built this synagogue, and eventually the building that they put up was on State and Clark.
A lot of people from like Chicago and New York and from the South sent their children up here to school. Sometimes they'd have a problem and they didn't know anybody and they'd call my father. And so it came to the point where he thought the Jewish students needed sort of a central place, you know, where they could get some help and know other students. When they built a temple, he wanted to build it over close to the campus so that students could use it because there were more and more students all the time. But he was up in Michigan or something when they brought it up to the congregation, and they voted not to do that. They built the temple at the corner of Clark Street and State Street.
By the 1880s, young Eastern European Jews were immigrating to America, and by the mid-1920s, the Jewish population swelled to close to 2 million. While the synagogue was where Champaign-Urbana Jews first congregated, soon there were other institutions playing a role in community formation. One such establishment was the nation's first Hillel Foundation, the Organization for Jewish Campus Life at the University of Illinois. By the early 1920s, there were 300 Jewish students at the U of I in Champaign-Urbana. Benjamin Frankel was a rabbinic intern at the Sinai Temple in Champaign. He saw the need for college Jews to explore their heritage. The Hillel concept made possible student-run opportunities under the watchful eye of a professional facilitator.
Hillel, which is the Jewish student organization, was founded here in 1928, I think. Hillel is now all over the world. Every college, major college campus or college campus of any size has a Hillel, just like we have Newman and other religious foundations, McKinley Foundation, all religious foundations. And the building that is at 5th and John was built in 1952. It was the very first purpose-built Hillel house. Before that and elsewhere, they would buy a house somewhere and turn it into a Hillel house. But this was built specifically for the Hillel Foundation. It is probably going to be torn down in the next year or two and rebuilt, a bigger and better Hillel building on the same plot of ground.
The Hillel here, it's so big. And there's so many students and so many programs, and it just blows me away. I'll call or I'll email my best friend from Reno or from Las Vegas that we grew up together, and I'll say, when we've done these programs where we were doing it, and there'd be like five people, and it was like, whoa, that's huge. And then you come here, and there's 150 people at a program, mm-hmm. or services where there'll be 700 people at a program. And it blows me away.
It's an organization which seeks to involve all of the different sects of Judaism in activities together. And this is great because a lot of the Jewish sects sort of, in a very inward-focused looking way, have excluded themselves socially from contact with other forms mm-hmm. of Judaism.
In the wake of World War I, Champaign-Urbana Jews realized a need to promote and support mission causes, including humanitarian relief and programs that foster multicultural understanding. Out of those discussions was formed the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, whose primary mission is to foster a vibrant Jewish future around the world.
The Federation started in the 30s there are two dates. Some say 1929, some say 1933. I think 1933 is probably more accurate because that's the year the Nazis came to power in Germany. And Jews who took Hitler seriously when he said he was going to make Germany free and Europe free of Jews, those who took him seriously began leaving, and some of them needed help and resettlement. So the federations all over the country made that a major project to help resettle German Jews. And so 33 is a key date. I have a friend in the community who likes to say the difference is that people say it's my temple, but our federation. And that means that people have, because it's a building and a place, a space, that people have a more proprietary interest in the place. It's my temple. I want them to do things my way. So when they don't do things my way, you'll hear about it. Whereas it's our federation. We're all in it together, all pooling our money for these projects, for worthy causes and providing services. I think that's not quite altogether true. I mean, there are people who, it's my federation and my money, and I want my money to go where I want it to go and not to go where I don't want it to go. But I think my friend was basically right. People have a more personal stake in the synagogue than they do in the federation, which is clearly a collective entity.
And the difference is now our temple was reform. And then as the congregation grew and our little temple, our nice little temple, burnt down. Somebody got an electrical problem on it and it burnt down. And so they built this new one out on Windsor. I think that was 1970.
Well, after the fire, Sinai bought some land very cleverly, anticipating that one day would have to move. The land that they bought was at Windsor and Duncan. Now, in the 70s, Windsor and Duncan was the end of the world. There was nothing out there. So people said, you can't put a synagogue out there. That's going to fall off the edge of the world, the edge of the earth. It's too far away. But they said, no, 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 the community will grow in that direction. And we have a lot of land there, a lot of parking, room to expand, grounds that we never had before. And so in 1974, I think it was, the synagogue was dedicated.
They had beautiful stained glass windows in our original temple, and they were able to save those, and they put them up, but they weren't put in a place that would let the light come through.
The decision was made that we move out. Parking was tough. The school wing, which wasn't damaged, was sold. We got insurance, and people raised money. And we moved out to the current location.
How can you describe the Jewish community in Champaign-Urbana?
There's probably only about 2,000 Jewish people in Champaign-Urbana who are not students at the university. It's big enough so that you have to make an effort to know everybody in it who's Jewish, but it's small enough that if you do make that effort, you actually can know everybody in the Jewish community in Champaign-Urbana.
What do you think is the most prominent Jewish organization in Champaign-Urbana?
Well, it depends on what kind of Jew you are. If you're a religious Jew and not Orthodox or traditional, the most prominent religious institution in town is Sinai Temple. If you're a secular Jew, the most prominent institution in town is probably the Federation. If you are an Orthodox Jew, it used to be Hillel. Now, with the Chabad movement, there is another option in town. So there are two traditionally religious organizations in town. They all work very well together. So the most important Jewish institution in town is the Jewish community, in truth.
One of the things about our Jewish community that's different from larger metropolitan areas and maybe even small communities with Jews is that our community is incredibly open to diversity within the congregation and the community. Usually what happens in a place where there are any number of Jews is they judge each other based on their observance pattern, almost like saying, I'm more Jewish than you are because I do this.
There's a lot of interaction and very little what we call in the trade balkanization, separation. Jews over here doing this and Jews over here don't talk to those Jews. Doesn't mean the Jews don't fight and we don't talk to each other at given times. But there's a lot of variety in working together. And the great thing about this Jewish community is just that.
The temple survived because of active members. We're not a wealthy community. We're not a large community. But we are extremely active.
There is a great deal of diversity among the Champaign-Urbana Jewish community, but many leaders in the community consider that a strength rather than a weakness. There are certainly issues revolving around how one expresses faith, but also there are issues of culture.
For me to be Jewish means to belong to an ancient and glorious tradition. I remember in New York, I did not attend religious services every week, because subconsciously I thought that they don't really need me, that there are so many Jews who live in the neighborhood that the services will be well attended. Whereas here in America, in a small town like Champaign, I know that if I don't go to those services, they will not have the quorum of 10 people without which you cannot have a normal service.
It means a lot of things. It means finding my own relationship to traditional Jewish practice. It means finding a role for myself within the Jewish community. It means trying to learn what I can about Jewish civilization, which is an ancient treasure house of wisdom. It means conducting myself in an ethical way in accordance with the ethical tenets of Judaism. And for me, it also means having a relationship with the State of Israel, which is the only Jewish country in the world.
To be myself in a world where studying the Hebrew texts and living the culture and living the ritual is important for me to integrate into my secular life.
Well, it means the religious part, which my family really wasn't. They had revolted against their parents, who were quite Orthodox, so they had very little. And I revolted against them and had a little more interest. And then later on, really learned a little Hebrew. But it's cultural, it's religious, it's the kind of jokes, it's everything. The old joke about the guy who goes to the synagogue very often, someone asks, why are you going? You're not really religious. And he says, I go to talk to Goldberg, and Goldberg comes to talk to God. There's a little of that, and that's all right, too. I think religion gets looked at in this country from a Christian standpoint, which is kind of what you do on Sunday. And this is very different. It's all of life, and for better or worse.
It would be sort of bizarre for a Muslim to stand up and say, I'm a Muslim, but I don't believe in Allah. Or for a Christian to say, I'm a Christian, but I don't believe in Christ. For a Jew to stand up and say, I don't believe in God, it's just everybody says, yes, so let's move on to the next issue. So that's the secular side. On the religious side, it gives you a worldview, it gives you a belief system, it gives you a way to look at reality. And that's why Judaism, I think, at least of the Western religions, is more complicated. You really have to determine who the person is and what does it mean when a person says, I'm Jewish. And self-declarations are difficult because there are these people called Jews for Jesus who are Jewish but say they believe in Jesus, and that's curious to both Jews and Christians, actually. It's much more complicated than I think either being a Christian or being a Muslim are, because these are basically just religions. They don't have an ethnic strain to them. But Jews do, in addition to having this complex religious system.
American Jews today face soaring intermarriage rates, rampant assimilation, and diminishing population. Perhaps more than ever before, the American Jewish community has become concerned with issues of Jewish identification and continuity. At the forefront is greater preoccupation with self-identity and family. For many Champaign-Urbana Jews, family observance of the Jewish holidays and weekly ritual have become a primary expression of Jewish identity.
I grew up in Champaign-Urbana. And my family defined themselves as conservative Jews, which meant we were not the most observant and we were not the most liberal as far as the continuum of ritual in Judaism. My family would have an Erev Shabbat meal every Friday night. We would all be at home and we would have our Sabbath dinner and we would say the prayers that are a part of Sabbath dinner. Sometimes I would go to temple on Friday night and sometimes I wouldn't. We mostly went to services for the high holidays and other major Jewish holidays at the Hillel Foundation on campus because that was the place you would go if you were not Reform. But I also went to Sunday school at Sinai Temple in Champaign. I went to Uni High also to Friday night basketball games, which I had to go to because I was a cheerleader and because they were the most important thing in the week. My mother would still give me my Sabbath dinner early and say, well, here it is, even though you're rushing off. So they had a sense that they wanted me to enjoy my Judaism, but also define for myself how that worked with my other life and everything else that I had going on.
Can you describe your childhood from the perspective of a young Jewish girl?
It was a very protected childhood in that perspective. I grew up mostly amongst my family, my Jewish family, my extended family. We lived very close together. We went to the same temple. We went to the same Hebrew school. We went to the same schools, primary schools, and later on grammar schools that you would call high school. And the only difference between me and my cousins is that I and my brothers had quite an extensive Hebrew education. My mother was the daughter of a man who technically never became a rabbi in the accepted sense, but he was trained as a rabbi. He lived in what was known as White Russia in the end of the 19th century. He emigrated with his fiancée, which became my grandmother, around the 1890s. And they married in England. He had intended to come to the United States, but I think when the boat docked in London or Liverpool, I'm not sure where, he ran out of money. And so I'm British rather than American. He and his wife married, and they had five children. And my mother was the youngest. My grandfather was a Hebrew teacher and what you would call a socialist activist back in the East End of London. And he met a man called Theodor Herzl. He became fired up with the idea of a homeland for Jews in what was then Palestine. He decided that he was not going to teach children Hebrew and Jewish studies in Yiddish, as they were traditionally taught, but in the language of Hebrew. The rabbis in London at that time were horrified that he was going to use the holy tongue as a secular language, and they refused to give him ordination. But amongst his friends, he was known as Reverend, and he established a school called the Talmud Torah, which just means studying the Torah in the traditional tongue, but he did it in Hebrew. And many, many of his pupils became early settlers to Palestine and some of the first members of the Israeli government. So my background was involved not in learning Yiddish, unfortunately, that's something I've always regretted, but in Hebrew studies. And his eldest son, my uncle, taught me Hebrew, both biblical and modern Hebrew. And so that's my background.
My family all sings, and I have a sister who's a well-known opera singer, and my brother and my parents. So there was a lot of joy in our household. Things were fun. They weren't a chore. I mean, it wasn't like I had to do it. It was great. And I had a neighbor living next door who went to the Presbyterian church, and she liked to just come over and hang out just because the music was so good. So I think that had a big part of me growing up in a small community as a minority, but just loving it because my parents made it so much fun.
So when you were a child, who were your religious role models?
That's a really good question. In a way, my grandfather, even though he did not approve of women as Jewish leaders. And let me explain. He came from a very traditional background. He was very radical in that he taught Hebrew to Jewish students rather than Yiddish. But women were not supposed to learn Hebrew. So he spoke Yiddish to his wife and Yiddish to his two daughters, even though he insisted on his sons learning Hebrew. And he spoke Hebrew to my brothers, but not to me. So when I tried, and I was quite aggressive in that way when I look back on it now, when I wanted to participate in my brother's, younger brother's Hebrew lessons, my older brother had already left home, my grandfather didn't approve and he didn't want me to speak up. So it was very strange when I came here and offered my services, and I offered because of my knowledge, relative knowledge in Hebrew background compared to a lot of other people, and some musical education that I'd had as a child. But I thought that my grandfather would probably be spinning in his grave to know that his granddaughter was taking the part of what would traditionally be done by a man. But otherwise, I had a full secular education, and I went on to university to study science. I became a scientist for many years.
I didn't go to Sunday school, I guess, until 1920. And by that time, we had this temple, and the Sunday school was in the basement. It was just one big room, and they had dividers, you know. And we didn't have any Jewish scholars. Parents would come, and they'd have to read up a little bit first. So I don't really feel I had an education in that respect. My father always said, it's not what you do on Sunday, it's what you do the rest of the week.
I was a straight-A student, I was a presidential scholar, so I was like in sixth grade, so I got these big awards for, you know, having straight A's and never having anything less than an A. Woohoo, big deal. My Hebrew school teacher, he found that out, and he made fun of me for not being able to read Hebrew. I had a tremendous time with Hebrew and math. But, of course, the math part we were able to get tutors for. With Hebrew, it wasn't the same. And he went on in front of all my classmates and my peers. And then he even took a stretch to try to link that because my mom didn't convert with our congregation that she had converted before that, that maybe I wasn't really Jewish. That's not what you say to a sixth grader. That's the worst thing possible. So I faked a stomach ache for like 3 months. I mean, I convinced my mom that I did have stomach pains, but I was making myself sick. Mm-hmm. And so it really hit me when I was in college that there are so many negative, nasty teachers out there in this world, and that I had to do something to not be like that guy. And so I taught Hebrew school in high school and in college, and it just hit me that I wanted to work with kids and give them a positive experience to make up for all this guy's bad ones. And that's really what did it.
My family comes from Eastern Europe. My grandmother on my father's side had certain attitudes about life that were based on her European background, and she was very strict. She was precise about her rules of what you could eat, what you couldn't eat, when you could travel, when you couldn't travel. And because of that, if we wanted to have a relationship with my grandmother, we had to visit her. Because she could never visit us. Even though we kept kosher, we weren't kosher enough for her. And since my parents worked, the only time that she could travel would be on the Sabbath, and she wouldn't travel on the Sabbath.
Growing up in Las Vegas was so different, as you guys can imagine, you know. We always had our Passover Seders in a casino. I mean, not in a casino with, you know, on the casino floor, but it was in a hotel. And so, for example, when songs would be sung, you could also hear the clinking of the, you know, depending on where it was, you could really hear the slot machines in the background. And there'd be times when, like, we'd have a reflective moment or it'd be quiet for, like, a prayer, and you'd hear blackjack in the back of the back. So I recognize now that that was not what every normal, you know, family experiences.
I grew up in my grandmother's house. First 8 years of my life, it was kosher. When my parents had their own house, we did not keep kosher. My father would order ham sandwiches outside. I was mildly shocked when he did that. But no, they didn't ever have a kosher house. My wife and I did not either when we were first married. But when we made this commitment to make our lives more Jewish, that was a part of it. But we didn't go as far as dietary laws require. But we did decide that we would no longer bring pork products or shellfish into the house. Now, if we were really going to go all the way, we would have different sets of dishes, some for milk, some for dairy, some for in between. We didn't go that way, but we did make that commitment, and that meant giving up clam chowder and pepperoni on pizza and other nice things that we used to bring into the house quite regularly. And I must say there are levels, even among Orthodox Jews, of how rigorously one observes the dietary laws.
How did you bring your children up, and how do you think it affected their Jewish life?
Well, we brought them up the way parents bring up kids. I mean, we brought them up in this town. They were active in the congregation. My son had a bar mitzvah here. My daughter had a bat mitzvah here. They went to uni. There's a wonderful story. Passover's coming, and we always have a Seder. And for all of the time they were growing up, we always said they could stay home the first day. So one day my wife calls up and says, Avi and Zipporah will be missing school for Passover. And the person in the office asks, will they be missing 1 day, 2 days, or 4 days? Because they had Jews at uni in those years. Some who were Reformed Jews were missing 1 day. Some of whom were conservative Jews who were missing 2 days. And some who were Orthodox Jews who were going to miss 4 days. And she had dealt with all of those people, so missing a day for Passover meant nothing to her. She needed to know how many days you were missing. Both of them have a real Jewish identity. My son married a Catholic. She's not going to convert, although I don't know what would happen if he asked her. But he's a very secular Jew who has done very curious things in his life. He played soccer at uni, and he went to the University of California at Santa Cruz, and he played soccer. So we were curious what Avi was going to do on Yom Kippur. Avi said, well, I'm going with the team. I'm not suiting up, and I'm not eating. I'm fasting, which is the tradition on Yom Kippur. So here was this crazy Jew sitting on the bench, not playing, but with the team, not eating. Now, his soccer coach was an Israeli. This soccer coach had never fasted in his entire life, and he was somewhere in his 30s. He's seen Avi fasting for the first time in his life. This guy fasted. He didn't play because he couldn't eat, but yet he was being his kind of Jew. My daughter-in-law has told her parents that Avi's not going to raise Christian children. They don't know what they're going to do yet. His sister, who is not married, is a more traditional conservative Jew. It gives meaning to gene pools and sibling differences. She does more of the tradition. She goes to services, and as it turns out, she goes to services in Venice, California, to the synagogue that her great-grandfather went to. She had no idea. She found this place. She liked it. She went, and I said, that's where I went with my grandfather and my grandmother, and she couldn't believe it. And actually, she's sitting in a sanctuary that four of her great-grandparents went to in the 60s and were major parts of the congregation, because my wife's grandparents also lived in the same neighborhood in Venice. And she had no idea when she found it. It was just purely, she lives in Santa Monica. She found a congregation she liked. It was really cheap. She was a student. They weren't going to charge her. And she went. And she said, I found this neat place. And we said, well, actually, your great-grandparents found that place in the 50s. And so it's sort of neat. So my kids are very different. Both of them have a keen sense that they're Jewish. One of them's a real secular Jew. And the other one, I think, if she gets married and has a family, will be more like her parents. She may even be more traditional than her parents. It's just hard to know. And I don't know what's going to happen as people change, because people grow and they change and their lives change and their religious practices change.
A little singing hits fire, the bus is a mechaya. The melody is an old, nor the better than a naya. Dusky sing, hot ninzel, say this in oil bobbes. In der Tat, the fleck, the singing, noch in Kirchschades.
Listening to The 20th Century Exodus, The Triumphant Life and Journeys of the Jewish in Our Community. I'm Ruth Welch. Since World War II, the Jewish population in the U.S. has remained relatively flat. The 2000 census reports that just over 5 million Jews reside in America, roughly 2% of the total population. In the 1950s, the intermarriage rate among Jews was roughly 6%. Today, it approaches 50%. Many Jews are concerned with this trend towards secularization, even as new centers of Jewish community continue to form. Champaign-Urbana Jews say traditions and rituals have an important role to play in passing on Jewish faith and culture to future generations, as well as cementing family bonds.
The most memorable thing about my bar mitzvah is there was a 50s comedian called Pinky Lee with a checkered hat and a checkered coat who had a TV show, one of the early children's shows in the 50s. And where we had my reception, Pinky Lee was there that time. He was on his way out of favor. And that was the big event.
All these two little magic words can open any door with ease. One little word is thanks. And the other little word is please. That's why I sang that song, boys and girls, because those are two important words. And I want you to always remember to love, honor, and respect your mommy and daddy, and always say thanks and please. This is our last show from Fun Forest, and I want to thank you all.
We all went and saw Pinky Lee with his checkered hat and checkered coat and very bad comedy and very bad songs, and that was the party.
Did you have a bar mitzvah when you were 13?
Oh, yes.
What do you remember most about it?
I remember that I had to share it with another boy because there were so many families, so many children my age in the synagogue that you couldn't get a Saturday just to yourself. You had to have a what we called the double bar mitzvah. And he was not a friend of mine particularly. In fact, I actually didn't like the kid. And yet we had to work very closely together and share these things. Our families didn't get on very well either. But it came off. I also remember my father in later years used to joke about this. I had to wear the uniform. The uniform was a blue suit and blue suede shoes and a certain kind of collar, tie, and I insisted that I couldn't be bar mitzvah without these things. My parents thought this was kind of amusing. They partially indulged it. I remember it was a great pleasure for my grandmother, whom I loved very much and had lived with the first 8 years of my life, that she came from Rochester for the occasion, of course, and it meant a lot to her, and 3 years later she was dead. So there were some good things about it.
My sister, who also went to Uni High, didn't want to have to deal with defining herself as a Jew, and she always was a Zionist, so she moved to Israel. She got her degree at Oberlin and then the University of Illinois, and then she It's called Making Aliyah. When you go to Israel, you go up to live in this land and you return to the land of your forefathers. So she made Aliyah as a young woman before she was married, before she had a family, and she made her life there. When she got there, they said to her, you know, if you really want a great career in opera, you really need to go to Germany and you need to work in the opera houses in Europe. And she said, but I came here to live here. I could have made my name in New York if I wanted to do that. So she stayed there and she made quite a nice career for herself.
We celebrated everything. We had in the household, in those days, you had people that lived in the house that helped you. And we had Catholics, and so we had fish on Friday night. We had a Seventh-day Adventist that fired the furnace. And we celebrated Auntie Buck, as we called her, took care of us. She put an orange and a walnut in our Christmas stocking that we hung up. And we had Easter eggs. My mother hid them in the house, because otherwise it might be damp. So she put them in our bedroom slippers. But we celebrated what everybody else did.
I dash out on Friday evening. I'm chief usher at the temple. I got to be there pretty early. And my dog was always unhappy, you know. You can't just stay home one night. And so what I did finally was to realize that she's got to have some very pleasant association. So she gets a very special cookie with a lot of fat in it only on Friday night. So all I have to say is, Malka, what day is it? And she goes nuts. So it's making the Sabbath a different time the week, trying not to work most of it, if I can do that, and having a nap, you know, kind of enjoying yourself gently on it, and then saying goodbye to it with regret. There's a little ceremony for that, which is usually done with more people than one. But holidays, you know, Passover's coming up. It means cleaning the house from top to bottom. It means getting the foods for Passover. Almost nothing you eat the rest of the year will do. And I'm much more observant about dietary stuff on Passover. People who don't pay much attention to it most of the year get a little fanatical at Passover. And I join them.
Well, I have a kid that when I was hired, he, like you guys, I mean, he's really smart. He's really funny. He has a lot of special skills. But for some reason, every teacher that he had couldn't connect with. When we're talking Sunday school or religious school, it's really twice a week, Wednesday afternoons and Sunday mornings. And it's like we're really in competition with all of the other specialty stuff. You know, other people might have soccer lessons or cello lessons or whatever else. And it's like, why would kids want to come here? You know, when they're forced to go, if you guys have CCD or, you know, maybe different religions have that same kind of, you have to go, your parents are making you. And so what I like best about my job is that I have a kid that I connected with and I found something that he liked. And it meant so much to me that kid really can find and be happy with their culture and their identity. And suddenly he's totally changed. Him and his brother both have become where they really kind of, they dig it. It's part of who they are. And when I can make that connection with a kid, that makes it all worth it.
I remember some years ago I attended a conference at Oxford University in England. And I saw that several people at the conference ate nothing but dry cereal and milk because they wouldn't eat any other food which was not kosher. So I decided to help these people out, and I did some research, and I discovered that there was one grocery in town which also served hot meals, which the Orthodox Jews in my group could eat because they were vegans. They didn't eat any meat and they didn't eat any fish. And they only ate vegetables or cooked vegetables. And I have somewhere a photograph of a dozen men in turbans, Indians, in that grocery, together with a few bearded men with yarmulkes who were Orthodox Jews, and they shared peacefully the vegan meals.
You practice Judaism in your home now with your children?
We have a kosher home. My children are at college and out working now, so it's just my husband and I. But we have a kosher home. We use two sets of dishes, dairy and meat, and we have a set of dishes for Passover. In fact, I was only delighted to come out this evening because it got me out of the kitchen the week before Passover. It's probably the busiest one of the year for me. So Judaism is very much a domestic situation.
A major challenge facing American Jews today is how best to install a Jewish identity in every young Jew, to educate the next generation about their heritage. Studies have demonstrated that short and long-term experiences can have a tremendous impact on young people's connection to Judaism and Israel. A 2003 study from the Orthodox Union says there's a need for community-wide programs emphasizing Jewish education, that synagogues need to be strengthened to improve both observance and hospitality, and that Jewish families need to stress Jewish traditions. Another helpful solution is exposure to role models who espouse Jewish values.
Did you have any Jewish role models when you were growing up?
My parents, to a degree.
My parents, to start with. My mother was raised as a liberal Jew, so she came to becoming Orthodox briefly during my childhood because of my father, who had been raised as an Orthodox Jew. But I found that my parents had remarkably little concern for the distinctions, the denominational aspects of Judaism.
My parents were very much part of Jewish communal life and institutional Jewish life. I don't think they were very religious in a personal sense, and I miss that. I also found that I didn't altogether want to model myself after them. My in-laws, by contrast, were exactly the opposite. They had very little use for, you know, synagogue life or Jewish communal life, but they were, in their own way, very religious people, and they were models too. So I found, I guess, what was missing there.
In terms of my specific practices as a Jew, I'm sure they're geared partly by my parents and how they raised me. But my attitude towards Judaism is largely a result of my Jewish education, some of the great teachers I had as a kid.
And then there was the chemistry teacher who became my dressing role model. They passed a rule in our high school that you needed to wear a tie. He came into class one day without a tie and said, "If this is the only reason you're going to respect me, it's because I'm wearing a tie, I don't want your respect." And in a small town, very conservative, for a teacher to stand up and do this, something I just vividly remember, that there are many ways to respect the person and that dress code is not necessarily one of them. And there are some stupid, trivial requirements that people make, which probably we don't need all the time.
Our friend Victor, the rabbi in New Orleans that we went to visit, became a role model.
The rabbis that have been associated with my life are my main Jewish role models.
When I went to the University of Illinois, a young rabbi came here with his wife.
Probably the person who most directly influenced me was my rabbi when I was in high school. Rabbi Walter Plout, who's not a famous rabbi because he died relatively young.
His name was Eddie Feld, and his wife was Merle Feld, and she was a grown-up because she was the Rebbetzin. But only years later, when we became such good friends, did I realize she was only 3 or 4 years older than I was. He was my rabbi, my Hillel rabbi, when I was in college, and he and Merle, too, were just so much about teaching and so much about social justice.
He showed us that Sabbath, Jewish Sabbath, could be full of so much joy. It wasn't the kind of day that you can't do this and you're not allowed to do that. It was not a day of prohibitions. It was a day of opportunities, of special things. This is the day you get to do something you don't do other days during the week. And that attitude was also important. That was a model for us as well.
He was a Jew who had emigrated from Germany right before World War II. He sort of had been saved from being killed in the Holocaust by the Reform Movement, who brought him to the United States to study, finish rabbinical school here. I found him to be a remarkably humane, very pleasant, intelligent, emotionally deep person, and also very socially involved. And I found myself wanting to be like him.
It was the student strike of the 70s, and Hillel was a place where we would go to make our pamphlets and run back out and do anti-war stuff. And so it was a combination of Jewish learning, and he was very mystical, and Hasidic learning, and learning about mysticism, but social justice. And everything about the way he led his life wasn't just teaching about it, but an example of that as well.
The importance of social action and being involved in the community stems from various religious school teachers I had who were just terrific. I remember some of the people we had were international lawyers who took us to visit homes of people who were poor in Great Neck, which was a real eye-opening experience for most of the kids there because we were upper-middle-class or middle-class kids. We didn't even know what poverty was until they'd taken us to settlement houses and things like that. We learned about how many people lived that we had to be more concerned about than we were as kids.
I also had a wonderful teacher and rabbi in Sinai Temple named James Rudin when I was a high school kid. And he also, he was marching in Selma. He was making the differentiations of the prophets between those things we do which are just ritually commanded, which he didn't think were very important, and the important business of repairing the world, which is what we really all should be doing. Mm-hmm. So I've had some wonderful, wonderful teachers.
Growing up Jewish in the 20th century was by no means easy. Anti-Semitism has touched most Jews at some point in their lives. In 2004, the U.S. Congress enacted the Global Anti-Semitism Act to issue a report documenting prejudice and hatred against Jews, both in the U.S. and the world. The State Department released its report in January of 2005. It says anti-Semitism occurred in 62 countries from July of 2004 through mid-December of 2004. But it celebrated efforts to eradicate anti-Semitism from conferences in Spain, Vienna, and Berlin, which recognized anti-Semitism as a fundamental violation of human rights. It also recognized efforts in the U.S. to financially compensate survivors of the Holocaust and their families. Still, much needs to be done to fight anti-Semitic behavior. A nationwide survey only last year, conducted by the Anti-Defamation League, showed that 14% of Americans, nearly 35 million in all, hold anti-Semitic attitudes.
A woman next to us was a very traditional Christian, and she had no children in town. So my father took care of her for a long time. And when she got ready to die, she was in tears because she knew how good my dad was and how good he'd been to her. And she was sad because he wasn't going to heaven because he was Jewish, and she would never see him again. And it really bothered her. She was in her 90s when she died. And I just remember that because I remember seeing her virtually on her deathbed and how sad she was that she was never going to see us again because we were Jewish. And it made her more sad than it made us. I mean, I was probably too young to figure out what was going on.
The same kids who I used to be in the Boy Scout troop with once stole my bicycle. And I actually saw them stealing it, and I ran after them, and I said, "Why'd you do that?" They said, "Well, you're Jewish." You know, it was like something that they felt that was perfectly reasonable to do. And, you know, it's really shocked me.
The only real incident that I had, I guess, as a result of being Jewish was in my English class when I was about 15. We had a student teacher who, you know, was very close to our own age, actually, and had no experience dealing with this kind of thing. And the actual teacher of the course had left the room at the end of the hour as I was writing the last question of an exam. Uh-huh. And a fellow came in from the next class who observed that I was Jewish and began saying a number of racist or ethnocentric things against Jews and how he was going to beat me up after school because I was Jewish, etc., etc. And I must say, to the credit of the Urbana High School administration, they dealt with this very promptly and let him know that such behavior was not acceptable in no uncertain terms, or practically begging me to call the police, although I told them that I would prefer if they did not. I don't know what they actually did. But, I mean, basically they made it very clear to this fellow that he would be punished extremely for doing this again to anyone, not just me. So, you know, it was a bad experience, but the amazing help that I got from the school really made me feel so much better.
When I was an undergraduate at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, I lived in a small community 15 miles northeast of Madison. It was a little town called Marshall, and we lived on a farm. And the town had a little main street, and I remember driving through it one day, or walking through it, and seeing on the barbershop window a sign that said, "No Jews, dogs, or niggers," or something rather, allowed. And I was thinking, gee, this is outrageous. And I just walked in and I said, "You better take that sign right down or I'm going to call the police."
When I was about 8, I had a girl come up to me and I was wearing a Jewish star and she said, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, it's a Jewish star. You know, I'm Jewish." And she turned to me, honestly, I mean, this is, you know, these were in the 80s. Why would people say this? And she turned to me and she said, "Where's your horns?" That's what she really believed. So there's been those moments where I've had discrimination and it's sad and it happens and, you know, it's out there.
Soll der Qualsach ruhig fließen, stiller sei und hoff. Mit der Freiheit kommt der Tatel, schlafsche Kind, mein Schlaf. Wie die Wilje, aber Breite, wie die Bämer, grün beneite, leicht bald Freiheitslicht auf dein Gehirn.
Despite the issues we've highlighted, extensive assimilation, declining population, rising intermarriage rates, and anti-Semitism, Jews in Champaign-Urbana are hopeful for the future. They say there's a growing desire to find new ways not only to cooperate with one another in order to share Jewish heritage with the next generation, but also to celebrate their differences.
Some people say that there's a demise in the Jewish community of the U.S. Can you comment on that?
I think what they're referring to when they say that is the demographic surveys that show that there's a great deal of assimilation taking place. Intermarriage cannot help but dilute the Jewish content in any household. The markers of being Jewish are less intense than they were, say, a generation ago. Look magazine 40 years ago predicted on the basis of such demographic studies, surveys, that Judaism would essentially cease to exist in America within 30 years. It's Look magazine that has ceased to exist. The Jewish community is going strong.
What would you like to see for the future of the Jewish community of Champaign-Urbana?
Well, I've seen it grow not only in numbers, but in confidence and in strength. At one time, people didn't want to talk about things that could cause dissension. Now there's none of that. It's a confident, strong community that can take all sorts of conflicts, internal and external, etc., and learn from them rather than fear them. So if it continues the way it's gone, that'll be great.
My hope is that the Jewish awareness, Jewish pride, social action should only grow and grow. And there should be a lot more than what we have today. We should look back in a year from now and say that there's more. And it should be a beautiful city that anyone could have what they need.
I think that I'd like to see a couple of things, and I feel like I work toward it every day. One is to make sure that a vibrant Jewish community exists here for the coming generations, that we are able to be Jewish, to live safely, and to enjoy our culture and our heritage and our religion. Being Jewish, not all Jews want to be religious, but if they want to be religious, that they can be. But I think there's another piece of it too, which is to have within the Jewish community, not just the Jewish versus the non-Jewish community, but within the Jewish community, to encourage all the different parts of the Jewish community to operate harmoniously, whether they believe the same things or whether they do the same things, that's not important. The important thing is that they respect each other and they get along and not waste their energies and create ill will by criticizing each other and being punitive toward each other, that they set a model of being tolerant and decent to each other.
What visions do you have for the Jewish community in Champaign-Urbana and in the world for the future?
Well, I hope it promotes consideration for others, regardless of their religion. I hope it teaches people to be exemplary in every way they can.
What is your vision for the future Jewish community?
Oh, my goodness. I would like to see a Jewish community in which mutual respect and pluralism is absolutely valued, and where everyone understands what I think is critical, which is that the Jewish people, despite their different choices, are one. That's sort of not as much in vogue as it was some years back when I was president of our federation here. But I still think that that is the way Judaism will stay healthy, is to have Orthodox rabbis and conservative rabbis and reform rabbis and all the leaders of those communities and people who are not as religious, everybody meeting together and enjoying each other's company and being friends and respecting each other's choices.
Mainly, I would like to see better communication between the Orthodox and the other sects. I think it's a problem of both sides. And anyone who tells you that the Orthodox won't talk to us because they think we're heretics doesn't know what they're talking about. But also, anyone who tells you that the other sects just won't accept Orthodoxy, they don't get it, and they think we're freaks, also doesn't know what they're talking about. It's a two-way street. And what I would really like to see is both sides approach things in a way that encourages better communication. Guess sort of fulfilling in a community what Hillel is trying to do on campus. In other words, just, you know, what does it really matter except where you pray, what you do? Now, I don't want to give the impression either that it's like really rigid divisions, because it's a small enough community. Everyone knows everybody else, since there already is a lot of contact. But in another sense, there's not. So I would like to see just more activity, which I'm already beginning to see, and I'd like to see better communication between the sects.
I think it's important that all people know something about others around them. So personally, I think that it's good for the Jewish community, for the people in Central Illinois to know that we're here and who we are and what we do and how we're different than them and how we're the same as them. And I think it's important for us to know about our neighbors, too. I think it's important for Jews to know something about Christianity. I think it's important for all of us to know something about Islam and Buddhism. And there's a lot of stuff out there besides what we personally are. And I think the more we know about each other, the easier it is not to be afraid of each other, the easier it is not to hate each other, the easier it is not to force others to be exactly the way we are.
I thought I would sing something that many people know who are Jewish, and it speaks about peace. Ya'aseh shalom, ya'aseh shalom, shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael. Ya'aseh shalom, ya'aseh shalom, shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael. Ya'aseh shalom, ya'aseh shalom.
We hope you've enjoyed the 20th Century Exodus, the triumphant life and journeys of the Jewish in our community. This program was produced by University High School students Bethany Hutchins, Ruth Welch, Amelia Bro, and Anne Macheski. Interviews were conducted by the 2009 University High School sub-freshman class. Stories were contributed by Rabbi David Teichtel, Lee Melhado, Michael Shapiro, Maurice Friedberg, Ruth Youngerman, Rabbi Norman Klein, Arthur Robinson, Gary Porton, Barry Schweitzer, Lynn Wachtel, Rafe Melhado, and Rosalind Weinberg. For more information on this project, visit our website at will.uiuc.edu. The program was directed by Dave Dickey of AM 580 and University High School teacher Jenny Yi Kim. I'm Ruth Welch.
Years ago in Denver, Democrats nominated Barack Obama for president.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
This week, President Obama addresses the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for special coverage from NPR News.
Coverage starts Tuesday night at 7.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.